Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Hello and welcome to the Leaders Toolbox here on Radio at Firehouse.com. This is the July edition with Chief Richard Gassaway. The show here looks at issues and concerns of fire chiefs and fire officers across the country. Today we have a couple of questions which we are going to get into in just a minute, but I would just like to say that if you do have any questions, any problems you're having in your department, not just for an officer, but for a firefighter as well, something that has to do with the leadership of the department. If you would like to send in the questions, we'd love to get them on the show, answer them on the show. You can drop us an email at podcast@firehouse.com. Good afternoon, Chief. How are you?
Hi, Pete. I'm doing wonderful. Thanks.
Very good. I hope you guys had a safe holiday in Roseville there. Not too many problems going on.
No, it was actually a good holiday. Most of the people were relatively safe with their fireworks and their outdoor activities. So reading on firehouse.com, I see a lot of places in the country didn't fare as well. I'm sorry to see accidents involving fireworks and tragedies around the holidays.
Well, I guess it does happen in as many states as possible, you know, tried to ban it. Or, you know, we just did a podcast with Ed Camo last week to try and, you know, make these safety issues a little bit more prominent, but that didn't work out in some cities. But let's get back to the Leader's Toolbox here today. Rich, the first question is from a firefighter who's looking to make a career out of this this job. It's I'm a part-time firefighter with ambitions of making it my career. I have had several interviews for full-time positions and have been turned down each time. While I think I'm doing okay in the interviews, I don't have much experience doing them. What are some of the things I could be doing to better prepare myself for the next opportunity I have to interview with another department?
Well, that's a great question. And I have an opportunity to interview quite a number of people who apply for firefighting positions within our department. And the one thing that probably stands out the most for me is the candidates come into the interview unprepared and unpracticed. So I'd say for this candidate, I'd say to be better prepared and better practiced. And let me explain a little bit about what I mean by that. First off, this candidate's only going to get one chance to make a good first impression on that prospective employer. So for him or her, I would say dress appropriately for the position that you're seeking. If you're applying to be an entry-level firefighter, perhaps a suit and tie might be a little bit much. Slacks and a dress shirt or maybe even a tie without a full suit might be more appropriate for an entry-level position. If you're applying for an officer position or chief position, then maybe a suit would be okay. I would say arrive early, at least 15 minutes to upwards 30 minutes early for the interview. Somebody's paying attention. They're paying attention as to whether you're rushing in at the last minute or if you're there in plenty of time. And if you're there in plenty of time, you get to relax a little bit before your interview. I'd suggest you go to the restroom in advance of the interview. Make sure that you look right. Make sure that if you're wearing a tie, it's straight, that your hair looks right. Just kind of check your general appearance so that in the interview, that's not something that you're worrying about, because you're, again, only going to get one chance to make that first impression. So dress appropriately. When you're invited into the interview, don't automatically assume that there's a seat there for you with for you to use for the interview. I'd wait to be asked to be seated. If the room size and the number on the panel was appropriate. I would go around the room, shake the hands of each of the interviewers, and introduce myself to them. And I would especially pay attention to their name. If you're interviewing with two or three people, it's very impressive in an interview when a candidate meets you for the first time, if during the interview that candidate uses your name. As the interviewer, you pay attention when candidates gather that kind of detail and then are able to recall it quickly in the interview. So, say, for example, you know, I introduced myself to this candidate, and on the fifth question, which is my question to ask the candidate says, well, Chief Gassaway, here's the, you know, my answer, and I would be thinking to myself, wow, you know, this candidate just met me, and he is already remembering who I am. And I think that says a lot for a candidate. And while it might seem to be a small thing or an insignificant thing, remember that you're competing with a lot of people. So you might be in competition with a lot of good candidates. And what's going to separate you from the next candidate may be these little things that the interviewers remember. In your demeanor, you know, once you're asked to take a seat, you know, sit up properly. This is, you know, not a casual conversation, but it's an interview. So sit up properly, hands in your laps or hands on the tabletop. Don't have an ink pen or a paper clip or anything that you can fidget with. Try as hard as you can to control any of your nervous habits, like maybe picking lint off your sleeve while you're talking, or fidgeting in your chair while you're talking, because those things distract the interviewer, and you really want them to be paying focused attention to you as the candidate and not watching you do things that are distracting them or maybe even annoying them. Show some excitement when you're interviewing. Even though an interview has an air of seriousness about it, it's okay to be excited and to smile and to show some enthusiasm when you're answering the questions for the position that you're seeking. And you know, one of the things that can turn an interviewer or an interview panel off is a candidate who just appears to be too serious. And I know there'll be people out there who probably write in and say, you can't be too serious in an interview. Well, I've interviewed a lot of people, and I can tell you some candidates come in and they just seem too uptight. And when they're uptight, they make me uptight. When they're relaxed and easy to talk with, then it makes me more relaxed and more easy to listen to what they have to say. It's not as painful to listen to them when they're not really, you know, uptight and showing nervousness. And tied to that, I guess, is to not be intimidated. You're interviewing with people that you're going to work with. They're people who are just like you and I. You know, they want you to be successful. They want you to do your best in the interview. Don't be intimidated by that. It's look at it as more as an opportunity to meet and talk about yourself and talk about challenges that you've had in your life and whatever types of questions that they're asking. But don't let the idea of an interview get you intimidated or feeling overwhelmed, because it'll show. It'll show in the interview, and that's not a good quality to have. You know, if you're getting all uptight on an interview, the panel might be sitting there saying, geez, what's this person going to do when they're out on the scene of a fire if they're this uptight just in an interview? You know, there's nothing burning in this room. And so therefore, you know, kind of temper your anxiety if you're able to do it, or at least be very conscientious of it. Make good eye contact with the interview panel. When you're interviewing with say more than one person and they're asking you a question, make good eye contact with them while they're asking you the question. And then when you go to give your response, get your response with the person who asked you the question, but don't train in on just that person. You want to talk to everyone who's in the room. So you want to take your eyes and your body language and train it toward each person. So if you're interviewing with three people, you start with the person who asked you the question, and you give a little bit of your answer to them, and maybe you turn to the next person and explain a little bit of your answer to them and to the next person, so that you keep all of them engaged in your interview. You don't want somebody fading off and thinking about something else, or, you know, what are they going to have for lunch, or maybe they just got back from lunch and they're a little bit tired. You want to connect with each of the interviewers. You want them to feel engaged in your presentation. And you definitely want to be careful about taking your eyes and looking down at the floor or up in the corners of the rooms, or if there's a window in the room that leads to the outside or a window to the hallway, of being distracted about what's happening outside or happening out in the hallway. Sometimes interviewers will set a room up particularly just for that purpose. They'll have an open window behind them, or they'll have a window to a hallway behind them, because they want to see how easily the candidate will get distracted and pay attention to the things that are happening in places other than the room. So kind of get in the zone, get in the moment, let outside things not affect you, and stay honed on the task, and that is your interview, and giving your full attention to the interviewers. When they ask you a question, make sure that you understand the question. If you don't, ask them to repeat it or to clarify it. I think they'd appreciate making sure that you answer the question that they're seeking, instead of them asking you a question that requires the answer to be a color and you give a number. As an example, they'll appreciate that. If you don't know the answer to the question, and I would say even if you do know the answer to the question, take pause for a moment and think about how you want to form your response. So here's what I mean by an example. So say they ask you, use you as an example, Pete, what are your three greatest strengths that you would bring to our department? And you're sitting there thinking, I knew they were going to ask this one. I rehearsed this one. I'm prepared. I've got it. The last thing you want to do is let them know that you knew that question was coming, and your answer comes out so quick that you appear to be rehearsed and practiced, and you knew it was coming. Because the interviewer is going to say, okay, he knew that one was coming because he blurted out three things so fast and so without thinking that we know that he rehearsed that one. Alternatively, if they said, well, Pete, what are the three greatest strengths that you can bring to this organization, that you would pause for a moment and say something like, my three greatest strengths, and then just give just a second or two to give the appearance that you're giving some thoughtful consideration to the question. And then slowly and articulately give your first response, and then your second, and then your third. And by doing that, you're letting them see that you're being a thoughtful candidate. You're giving consideration to the question. Even if you have it well rehearsed, you're giving the appearance that I'm not giving you a canned, rehearsed response. I'm giving the question some thoughtful consideration, and then I'm answering. Now, why would you do this for the questions that you know the answer to already? It seems kind of dumb to do that. Well, if you do it consistently for all the questions, then the interviewers won't know which ones you really were rehearsed for and which ones really are stumping you. If you take the same approach to each question, pause thoughtfully, give it a moment of consideration, you won't be so nervous to think, oh, they're going to know I don't know the answer to this one because I paused. Pause for all of them. Give it a moment of thought, and then give your answer. So if they ask you a question that you really don't know the answer to, and you take that thoughtful pause, it's going to be the same as the one before where you knew it and you nailed it. So I would encourage candidates to take just a moment, mentally process an answer in their mind before they blurt it out. I see a lot of candidates that start with an answer, and then they say, wait a minute, I want to go to a different direction. Well, it's kind of hard to just hit the pause button or the rewind button in an interview. Once you say it, you say it, and it's hard for the interviewers to forget that you said it. You know, you can't play the jury will disregard that last comment. The jury, the interview panel, doesn't disregard the comments. They hear them all, and when you have to start over or regroup, it doesn't help you in the interview. Sometimes interviewers will ask you a question. Maybe it's a scenario-based question, and you'll start to give your response, and then they might question your decision or question your tactic, whatever that, you know, the question would be. It's say some scenario-based question, a fire ground or a personnel matter or something like that. And you start to give your response, and they say, you know, would you really do that? Almost like in disbelief. And if you read into that, boy, I must have said the wrong thing, and I better go a new direction. You might just be putting a nail in your coffin in the interview, because what you find yourself doing, and interviewers are real good interviewers, are good at picking up on this, is you start chasing your tail. And you start saying, well, boy, that must have been wrong. So I'll go a new direction. So you start down a new direction, and one of the other interviewers might say, you'd really do that? Oh, okay, well, I better go a new direction, because that, you know, I'm 0 for 2. I didn't, you know, those last, they obviously didn't like those last two, so I'll go a new direction. And then you end up, you don't even know where you're at, because you're given so many different varied responses, which leads into the next piece of advice. And that is, when you're interviewing and they ask you a question, give your best answer. Don't try to give the answer that you think the interviewers want to hear. One, it's transparent. Good interviewers pick up on that stuff, and the candidate may not know it, but good interviewers are able to pick up on that quick. And two, chances are, as the candidate, you don't know the interviewers well enough to really know what answer they're looking for in the first place. You know, sometimes in interview questions, much like the podcast here, there is no one right best answer to a question, but it's your answer. So pick your answer, stay true to it, and give it with confidence and conviction, and you know, when the interview is over, then you can reflect on whether you did a good job or not, or how you might answer it differently the next time. But mid-interview or mid-answer is not the place to stop and say, I want to go a new direction with this question, because you'll show yourself as being wishy-washy or indecisive or lacking confidence, and those are all traits that are not going to fare well with you in the interview. Do your homework. Know something about the organization that you're interviewing with. When you come into an interview, you should know something about that department. I'm continually amazed at how many people over my course of my entire career that I have interviewed, that at the end I say to them, "So what do you know about our department?" Not much. You're hiring. And that's what they know about the department. Well, that's not very impressive. So what you're telling me is you just applied here because it's a job. You really don't know much about this department, and you're not really all that interested in working for our department as much as you are just having a fire job. You know, that's not a very impressive response. If the candidate gets a chance to share with the interviewers what they know about the department, or if that's the form of one of the questions, they should have something to say. I know your department does this and this, and I know this about it and that about it. And how do you find this out? Well, you can talk to people who are on the department, talk to people who know people who are on the department, see if they have an annual report, see if they have a website, stop by one of their stations, stop by one of their drills, stop and talk, you know, with somebody to get some information about what that department's about. Because as an interviewer, I want to know that you want to work for my department, not just any fire department that'll hire you, and I need to be convinced that you know that there's a good reason why you want to work here, and that ties to another piece of advice that I have, that at the end of the interview, if they say, do you have any questions for us? And that's not unusual in an interview. Do you have any questions for us? I'd be ready with a question that relates to something that department is doing. Oh, yeah, I read in your annual report that your department does an XYZ fire prevention program, and I have a question about that, you know, and be ready with it. Have the question ready. You don't have to think of it on the fly. And ask them some question about something that department's doing. One, it shows your interest in the department, and two, it allows them to see that this person did some homework. They know something about our organization. And that scores points with an interview board. Now, what questions do you not want to ask at the end when they say, oh, do you have any questions for us? Avoid all the selfish questions like, what's this pay? What are my hours going to be? Do you pay for my training? How much time do I get off? Which station will I be assigned to? Avoid all of those. They may be legitimate questions, and you may have them. That's just not the place or the time to ask those questions. There will be another place and another time to ask those questions. So make this interview about putting forth your best foot, but not about being selfish enough to ask questions about that lead them to think that you're playing the what's in it for me card if I come to work for this organization. There'll be time in another place when they give you a second interview or they call to offer you a job that you can say, well, I have some questions. Can I stop in and talk with you about them? And there'll be time to do that then. If they give you the chance to have a closing statement, if they say, you know, would you like to say anything in closing, or even if they don't, as a candidate, you might say, well, I'd like to say something in closing here in the interview. I think it's always impressive for a candidate to say to the interview panel at the end of an interview, I've worked very hard to prepare myself for this job, and I'm paraphrasing. Each candidate can choose what else they want to say, you know, what they want to say in their own words. But I've worked very hard to prepare for this position, and this is a department that I really want to work for. I've waited for this opportunity for a while, and I feel that I'll do a good job for you because. And summarize whatever it is that your best points are, and don't be shy about saying I really want to have this job, because as interviewers. We interview a lot of candidates that I got to tell you, when that candidate leaves the room, I'm not so sure they even really wanted the job. I don't know that in their heart they wanted to be a firefighter, and I surely don't know that they wanted to be a firefighter on my department, and that doesn't leave me particularly impressed. So if you get a chance to have a closing statement and tell that interview panel, you know, I really want to be a firefighter, and I really want to be a firefighter here. And here's the reasons why. Da, 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 and here's what I have to offer. Da, 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 and make that your closing statement. How long should your answers be on interview questions? And this is probably going to strike some people as surprising. But I'd say that your answers shouldn't be any more than 30 seconds long to 1 minute long. And why? Well, interviewers, just like all other humans, have limited memory capacity, a limited span, and we'll listen very attentively to what the candidate says in the first 10, 20, 30 seconds, and then maybe upwards to a minute. But after a minute, we start hearing blah, 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 just like other people do. So pause, think about your best response, get the biggest, most important bullet points of your response out right up front, the kind of things that make the interviewer say, wow, that was a good answer. And then, once you get that out, shut up. Stop saying things. If you have some of the best candidates that I've interviewed, we set between a half an hour and 45 minutes aside for a candidate. Some of the best candidates that I've interviewed were in and out with 10 questions asked, in and out and gone in 15 minutes. And they gave some of the best, most succinct, right to the point, shortest answers that left me with the best impression. Because they were right on task, good solid responses, and when they were done, they shut up. They didn't keep babbling, and to where they're risking that I remember some of the babble and then forget some of the good answer that they were given. When you're done with the interview, make sure that you thank the panel if it's appropriate for the room size and the number on the panel. Shake each of their hands. Thank them. If you remember their names, thank them by name. Thank you, Chief So-and-so. Thank you, Captain So-and-so, for taking the time to give me an interview. That's just a courteous and professional thing to do. And then when you leave the interview, find somebody, administrative assistant, secretary, somebody in the office who knows the names and the proper spellings and the ranks of the people that you interviewed with, and write it down. And when you leave there, stop on your way home and pick up some thank you cards if you haven't done this already. Fill them out and get them in the mail that day. Now, you can also send a typewritten thank you, and that's okay as well. But you want to get a thank you out to them right away, thanking them for the opportunity to interview. And in your thank you, think about your interview and what you think the best, most shining moment of your interview was, something that they're going to remember you by. And in your thank you, mention that. Thank you for the opportunity to interview with you. I was really excited to talk about, or when we talked about this, or, you know, I felt really good about the question about whatever. So, and the reason you do that is, you know, they may interview 12 to 16 people in a day. And when they get your thank you the next day, so you're getting it out in the mail the day you interview, so that they get it the next day. They get, oh, I got mail. Open up the mail. It's a thank you card. Who's this from? Open it up. Oh, it's from a candidate. Well, I interviewed 16 of them. I wonder which one it was. I'll have to get the applications out to line up the names. Oh, no, wait a minute. Here he says in his interview, he said this, and that was a particularly good answer. Now I remember who this candidate is. Good candidate, gave a good answer, had the courtesy to send me a thank you as a follow-up that I get the next day. This must really be somebody who really wants to have this job. That's going to have an impact on the interviewers. And they might even check with each other and say, hey, did you get a thank you? Yeah, I did too. And so you might want to vary the wording a little bit, in each of the cards that you send to the interview panel, so it doesn't appear to be it was, you know, canned and prepared. And use that as an opportunity to get your name out there with them. Now, after the interview, how long do you wait to follow up? You got to give them a little bit of time. Sometimes in the interview they'll say, you know, we're going to be conducting interviews for the next week or the next month. Give them the time and space to get their interviews conducted. But when you know the interviews are done, it doesn't hurt to just give a courtesy follow-up call just to say, I want you to know that I'm really excited about the opportunity to come to work for the fire department. Wanted to see if you have any questions, any more information that I can provide for you, just to let them know you're interested. But I would only do that once, because once you start calling and following up more than once, then you start to become annoying. The interviewers are, the panel, are very busy people. And to call them once and say, I'm still interested, is a nice courtesy. To call them more than once is annoying, and chances are it's not going to help your chances of getting hired if you start to become, you know, kind of like a gnat that annoys the interviewers instead of letting them know that you are genuinely interested. So, in summary, for that candidate, I would say be well prepared. And be well practiced. Interviews are an opportunity for other people to form their perceptions of us. So I would say practice your interview on people who are going to give you honest feedback, if that's your spouse or a friend or a brother or sister or a parent, but somebody who, when you're done, isn't going to say, hey, you did great, because they like you. It needs to be somebody that says, you know, you did good, but here's some things that you need to do. You need to watch your eye contact. You need to be more optimistic in your answers. You know, some of your answers were just a little too vague. You need to be more specific. Somebody who's going to give you that honest feedback, or tape record your interview and play it back and watch it yourself. And again, it's a little hard to watch yourself. I know that. But you need to get practiced in how you do your interviews so that you see how you're performing. You're getting some honest feedback. So be well practiced and well prepared. Show up early, dress right, make a good first impression. Be succinct and short with your answers, and follow up when the interview is done.
Okay, Rich, thank you. One of the questions I have for you in relation to this is, I guess it's a time where they give you the floor. What about name dropping? I know most applications nowadays will ask you, did you hear about us on the web, or from a, you know, an employee, a friend, et cetera, et cetera. Is it wise to drop a name at that point?
No, I don't think it is. If you had a chance to drop a name, you should have put it in a reference on your application. And if I want to know how you know that person, and I see you know, on the reference, then I might ask you in the interview. So I see you put the governor as a reference on your application. Well, how do you know the governor? Well, you know, the governor's great niece's grandson's second cousin and I went to scout camp together 7 years ago. you know, if you're just dropping a name to think that that's going to get you someplace, probably not. If you genuinely know the person and you know them well enough, list them as a reference. And you know, a good interviewer will call that person and say, so you know this candidate? Oh, yeah, I know him. Well, tell me what you know about them. If you're going to use their name, you better hope they know you and they know you well, because I don't want to just, I don't want you to drop somebody's name because it's a big name and have that person say, well, I only know them because, you know, they mowed my grass one summer, but other than that, I don't know much about them. That's not going to, that's going to stink of name dropping. So I would avoid just dropping the names at the end of the interview. If you know them that well, really well, enough to list them as a reference, then list them as a reference on your application. Pete, that question also then prompted me for one more thing that I get asked often is, what if you're interviewing with a panel and you know somebody on that panel? Okay, so maybe somebody on that panel is somebody that you know well from church, or you hang out with their kids, or maybe you were on another department that they were on, or whatever, but you know somebody, you took a class with them, they taught a class that you took, something that gives you some pseudo-relationship with somebody on the panel. How do you deal with that when you come into the room? Well, when you come into the room, you treat that person as if they're in a position of authority and not a friend. So say, for example, if a candidate comes in to meet with me and they know me, it is in their best interest to introduce and shake my hand and say, hi, Chief Gasway, nice to see you again. And that doesn't let the rest of the panel know that I have any other relationship other than this candidate and I have previously met. You know, you don't want to walk in, the candidate to walk in and say, hey, Rich, how you doing? And, you know, how's the kids? And that's a little too casual. So keep it business professional in the interview, even if you know one of the interviewers. Shake their hand, use their title, use their last name, keep it business professional so that you're not trying to let the other interviewers think that you have some special tie to somebody who's on the interview panel. If that interviewer thinks enough of you when the interview is over and they're talking privately, he'll share with them that he knows you and what he or she knows about you and what, you know, what you might be able to contribute. Knowing somebody on the panel can be a double-edged sword. It can be helpful and it cannot be helpful. And you might think you have a wonderful relationship with someone, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you have the qualities that they're looking to have in an employment candidate. So there you go.
Okay, and back to the questions. You know, I know you said, you know, keep the answer to 30 seconds to a minute. And I guess it's all dependent on the type of question they ask you. But how in-depth would you get with some things, you know, if they ask you about, you know, your feelings, for instance, between, you know, fire prevention and you know, firefighting tactics, you know, do you feel the fire prevention is more important than firefighting tactics? Whether or not they ask that question, I don't know. But, you know, should you break into something saying, well, you know, I've read a lot of articles about, or you know, how much should you get into answering a question in a situation like that?
Well, the depth of your answer is not necessarily correlated to the length of your answer. In other words, you can be very deep in your thought, but still very brief in your answer. I cannot stress enough how much I am an advocate of candidates not droning on with their responses. That becomes agony for the interviewers, and we really do turn off, and we really do lose the most important things that a candidate has to say. I'm going to remember, and you know, people out there can like it or not like it. I'm going to remember what you say in the first 20 to 30 seconds, and I'm going to remember what you say in the last 10 seconds. So if your total response is 45 seconds to a minute, chances are I'm going to remember everything you say. If your responses are 4 minutes, I'm going to remember what you say in the first 30 seconds and the last 10 seconds, and everything else in between is going to kind of be lost anyhow. So I cannot stress enough the importance of being succinct with your answers. Now, I'm not saying shortcut them, and you know, if an answer required you to talk about, say, five different things, I would talk about all five things, but not in depth enough that I spend 5 minutes with it. I would talk about each thing for 15 or 20 seconds and get through my five things that I needed to talk about, and then sit there and be quiet. If they want more from me, they'll say, well, in number three, you said this. Tell me a little bit more about that. Sure, I'd be glad to. And there's your chance to elaborate for another minute on just number three. So don't assume that, you know, because we ask you a question, don't assume that we're interested in hearing your life story and everything that you have, you know, like an information dump. Here's everything I know about this. That's not what I want. I want the most succinct points about what you know about it. So if I were to ask you a question, Pete, picking up on what you said, about what's more important, fire prevention or fire suppression? Well, whatever your answer is, I'm not here to tell you what the best answer is. You formulate that yourself. But whatever your best answer is, find a succinct, to the point, strong way to get your point across to me. I think it's prevention. Here's why. 1, 2, 3. I think it's suppression. Here's why. 1, 2, 3. I think it's a balance between suppression and prevention, and here's why I think it needs to be balanced. 1, 2, 3. But don't tell me about everything that you've ever learned about suppression and everything you've ever learned about prevention, and because it'll just drone on. We'll just hear blah blah blah. Be short and sweet. Now, I'm not talking about one-sentence answers either. So when I say short and sweet, I don't mean say, I think it should be prevention, and sit there and be quiet. You know, we want to hear a little bit more than just a one-sentence answer. We want to hear your logic. We want to hear what you're thinking and why you're thinking that, but we don't want to hear it ad nauseum.
Okay. All right, we're going to take a quick break here on Radio at Firehouse.com. This is the Leader's Toolbox with Fire Chief Richard Gassaway.
Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Welcome back to the Leader's Toolbox here on Radio at Firehouse.com. This is a show with Fire Chief Richard Gassaway. Chief, I know you've been on the road. We spoke earlier in the week, and you said you've had a couple of road trips. Can you tell me what you've been up to, what you've seen across the country?
Yeah, Pete. I had an opportunity to take a group of young men to the National Fire Explorer Competition in Champaign, Illinois. And we sent five teams or so down from Minnesota to participate in the competition. There were about 700 explorers and 107 teams representing cities from all over the United States, including Alaska. And the Illinois Fire Service Institute just did a wonderful job both in providing facilities, lodging, instructional seminars, instructors to judge the competitions. The facility there is top notch. Some really nice props and simulators, and burn building and propane, and they burned a mobile home in a demonstration. They brought in a couple life flight helicopters. Just really, really did it up nice. So hats off to the folks at the Illinois Fire Service Institute for the job they did in hosting the National Fire Explorer competition. And hats off to all the young men and women who traveled there from nearby and great distances to participate in a week-long opportunity for learning and competition, and also creating friendships in the social activities that they had. Hats off to the Boy Scouts of America for having the program. And for young listeners out there who might be interested in fire exploring between the ages of 14 and 21, www.learningforlife.org is the website that will get them connected to the fire explorer groups in their community or nearby communities. So if you're interested in firefighting, and or if you know a young person who might be, get them involved. It's a great organization.
Well, that's a great program to become a part of. You know, definitely the future of the fire service for a lot of communities. I know when I was 16, I joined an explorer post in Rush, New York, and most everybody that I was in the post with at that time is now a member of that department, or has you know, moved to another community and has rejoined. So definitely a great opportunity for a youngster to learn about the fire service and really bring a lot of knowledge into the business.
And for those departments who don't have explorer posts, it's a great opportunity to get young people interested in the fire department, and a great tool for recruiting future firefighters is getting them when they're young and getting them trained. And when they turn 18 or 21 and can join the regular department, they've got a lot of training and experience and enthusiasm that can help a department in some of their recruitment and retention challenges.
Good. Well, let's hope maybe this podcast will help drum up a couple of departments to look into this option for helping with their recruitment and educational purposes. We'll get into the second question for today's show. It says, I've been a member of our fire company for 18 years and was recently elected to my second term as a captain. The challenge I have now is with the captain. I'm sorry, is with the chief and the appearance that he favors and supports the younger firefighters over the older firefighters. Our chief is 25 years old, and he was appointed by the mayor. He was not elected to the position. He's been with the department for about 4 years. Because he's younger, he's quite popular with the younger members, but not so popular with the older senior members. In fact, it feels as though he's slowly pushing away the older members from the department. This fellow is from a volunteer department with 27 members. They had 32 when the chief was appointed by the mayor, but they've lost the membership due to the poor leadership and unwillingness to work with the older firefighters. It's nice to have a young people joining the department and helping bolster the ranks, but it's upsetting because they can create problems and the chief won't do anything about it. How do we, as the older firefighters, approach the mayor, who just happens to be friends with the chief, to assure the safety and the morale in the firehouse?
Okay, well, good question, and not something that I think is terribly uncommon in the fire service. I'm going to start out by giving a little caveat here. I'm going to be talking about older members and younger members, and I don't mean physical age. When I'm talking about older members, I'll be talking about those who have senior level experience in the organization but may not necessarily be old. And when I talk about younger people, I'm going to be talking about newer members in the organization and not necessarily people who are young in age. So start off with, wow, chief at 25 years old. awfully young to be filling some pretty big shoes in the department. Not saying that it's impossible to be successful at 25, but It's a huge responsibility, and for somebody to be at that age fulfilling the chief's role, I think this young person should right up front realize they have a lot to learn from these senior members, a lot of opportunity to be coached and mentored, and to set aside the ego of being the chief of the department and realize that he or she is still in the phase of being a student of the fire service. Well, aren't we all, though? I'm going on 30 years, and I'm still a student of the fire service. But definitely still in the stage of learning for him. I took my first, this question was particularly intriguing to me. I took my first full-time career chief's job at the age of 28, so I was only 3 years older than what this candidate is, but I had served on a volunteer department for 10 years and had some experience as an officer. And in my full-time job, I had an opportunity to have a pretty good management position and a private employer and a good mentor who taught me a lot about leadership and personnel communications and getting along with people. So I felt kind of blessed. But I still, reflecting back, think that I was probably only marginally prepared to take that chief's job. And if there was anybody out there who was on my original department when I became the chief at 28, they're probably shaking their head and saying, "Yeah, you were marginally prepared, and it took us a long time to whip you into shape too." And to those folks, I acknowledge them and thank them for helping to mold my career. The current chief is probably quite likely underqualified and certainly unprepared to be the chief, but for some reason the mayor thinks otherwise, and the mayor has appointed him to be the chief, and that is a challenge. That's a problem. Assuming that for so long as the mayor is going to be in office, this chief is probably going to be the chief, and the challenge is find a way to work through this problem instead of just talking about it and finding a solution. There's a lot of frustrated firefighters out there and officers out there who are unhappy with the leadership they have in their organizations. I hear about it all the time. I get some feedback on the podcast when I say things like, go talk to the chief, and somebody will write in and say, "Talk to the chief? Who are you kidding? You must live in a dream world. These guys are so hung up on their egos, and you can't talk to them. You can't make any sense of matters with them. They're beyond help." And there's a lot of frustration out there with the leadership in some fire service organizations, and I acknowledge that. But in many cases, it's justified, but sometimes it's not. Sometimes we're just maybe not giving the chief the benefit of the doubt, realizing that person's human too, and maybe as much as you might not like what they're doing, they're trying to do the best job that they can. The best way that they know how. In this particular example of the situation we're dealing with, it isn't about just simply getting rid of the chief and getting a new one. It really isn't that easy. The challenge is to find a way to work with this chief and through the problem. And again, there'd be some listeners out there say, you just can't do that. Well, you can't just not do it either. You have to really try to bring a resolution to this. And I'm going to say to this person who's got these years of experience and the challenge with the chief, is to talk with that chief about what your concerns are and let them know what you're thinking. Now, when you do that, I would say be honest, but be respectful as well. Remember that the chief is the chief, and the position itself requires some level of respect. And even if it's just a young person who's got the position, who's maybe not ready for it, that they're still the chief of the department. When you meet with them, share your point of view with them, but also give the chief an opportunity to share their point of view as to how they see things. So it'd be a matter of not only talking, but also listening and trying to understand that person's point of view as well. What this writer is describing is what I would call a typical young versus old point of view, and this isn't a new problem for the fire service, we all tend to gravitate toward people that we can best relate with. So young people might gravitate toward young people because they like the same kind of music and they're into the same kind of things, and the older folks may gravitate toward older folks because they have the things that they're interested in, comfortable in. And when you cross generational lines, there becomes some discomfort in walking a distance in shoes that are uncomfortable. So to have this division of the young or newer members here and the older or senior members there is not particularly unusual in fire service organizations. And while the chief may be favoring the young members, I would challenge the writer here to reflect on his own perspective and make sure that he's not displaying the same kind of bias that the young chief is displaying toward the younger members, that he isn't displaying the same kind of bias in favor of the older members. In other words, the writer is saying, well, the chief is favoring the younger folks. I would challenge this writer to take pause and think, are you favoring the older folks? It's a two-way street here. It's easy to point the finger and blame and say, it's the chief's fault because he's not, reaching out to everyone. He's 25. He hasn't learned life's lessons yet. So I challenge this person to reach out to him and to try to help him see the perspective of the older firefighters. I know when I was a young firefighter, I thought, that I knew it all. And when I completed my firefighter training, I was on the top of my game, and there wasn't anything else to teach me. I knew how to do everything that I needed to do, and was probably a little strong in my opinions and beliefs of myself. And it's taken me a number of years to realize just how little I actually knew and how much that there was for me to learn from other people. Now, here at upwards pushing, 50 years old, I can say that that those lessons have been many and very beneficial for me. But at the time that I was young and invincible and thought that I knew more than I did, it was a little more difficult maybe to reach me and help me see different points of views and perspectives. So don't give up on the young chief, even though he might be a little bit hard to reach. Don't give up. Keep trying, because he is the chief, and your options are kind of limited until he's no longer the chief, or until he gets better. I suspect the young firefighters in that department might see the older members as maybe stubborn or stuck in their ways, or not willing to change or accept new ways of doing things, or embracing some modern firefighting techniques. And at the same time, I think the older firefighters might likely see the young members as rabble-rousers or being overzealous or disrespectful of the traditions of the department or disrespectful of the senior members and the contributions that they've given and the experience that they have. And I'm hoping that there are a lot of members, folks out there listening to the podcast, shaking their head saying, yeah, that's there's some of that in my department. I think there's some of that in every department. As long as you have the younger people and older people, you're going to have some of that differences. I think the middle ground is found in trying to develop some mutual respect and understanding about where each group of people are coming from. And that comes with talking, getting to know each other, understanding each other's perspective as to why they think the way they do, why different things are important to them, what their hot buttons are, what turns them on, turns them off. An older member might say, boy, it really, really makes me mad when these young people come in and they say this. And you talk to the young people and say, you know, the senior folks really get angry when you say this. Well, I don't mean anything by it. I didn't mean any harm by it. I didn't even realize it was offending them, in what I said. So, some of this could be going on, and some of the young members might be saying, them senior guys, when they do this and they do that, that it really bugs me. And the senior guys might be saying, geez, I'm just being me, I'm not trying to bug anybody, I'm just being myself, and sorry that it, creates the problems. But until these people get together and talk through some of this, they're not going to realize or respect their differences and find common ground in which to work. Because they do have to work. I mean, they got 27 members. They can't really afford to have much division in their organization. They're all going to be working together on calls because they don't have enough members to, find a way to work around it. I think it also comes down to some realization that we can't hold on to the past. We can't hold on and stop the march of time and the march of progress in our departments. And as much as we'd like to think we run a great department and, we spent many years building it up, for the older members, I challenge you to think, when you got on the department 30 years ago, it was a certain way. And over the course of that time, you've worked hard to march your organization forward and get it to where it is today. And there's a time when you have to allow younger people to take the baton and march it forward and help the organization be better tomorrow than it is today. And it's just the progression of organizations. But it's a little easier to be resilient to change when you're younger than when you're older. And I'll give them that, because I see some of that in my own life now as I'm getting older. It's a little more difficult to accept some changes and to see the points of views of young people the way that I might have seen them at one point. But what I have learned, though, is to respect their perspectives and their points of views and realize they're the future of this organization. It won't be but a blink of an eye, and I'll be retired and gone, and these young people will be the ones who will be carrying the helm of our department for the next 30 years, and I feel an obligation to engage them and to listen to them and to work with them toward making the department the best it can be. The new young chief represents change in the organization, and that's creating some anxiety. I think anytime you have a new leader, there's some anxiety. But when your new leader is 25 years old, it can create some extra special anxiety because you're concerned about, what's this person capable of doing, both good and bad. Now, the one thing that the writer wrote at the very end of the question that he didn't mention throughout the question was, how do we approach the mayor to ensure our safety? Now, he hadn't mentioned anywhere out throughout the question that he was concerned for the safety and well-being of the members. But if the new chief is doing things that are unsafe, that needs to be addressed right away. It needs to be addressed with him. It needs to be addressed in a meeting with him or a department meeting to talk about what's unsafe and how to stop that, whatever that unsafe act or actions are. I can say be patient with a new chief, a young chief, as they develop their leadership skills, but there's not a lot of room to be patient and forgiving if they're doing things that are unsafe for firefighters. So if that's the case, although he just makes brief mention of it at the very end, get on top of that right away. I think because this chief is 25 years old, I think there's an opportunity here. This isn't somebody who's 55 and set in their ways and stubborn and already have all their life's lessons learned. This person's kind of like a pile of clay that can be molded. They shouldn't be set in their ways and already be opinionated and locked on to one way of doing things. When you're 25 years old, chances are, there's a lot of capacity there to learn and to be taught and to be coached and to be mentored. And for these senior folks on this department, I'd say, man, look at this as a great opportunity to maybe help coach and develop a young person who could be end up being a great chief down the road. But it's gonna take some work. I'd encourage you not to give up and keep trying. And if it doesn't work one way, try to find another way to reach him. Try a different angle. You know, if you meet with him formally in the office and that doesn't work, maybe invite him out for a beverage of whatever choice, and talk with them that way, or invite them over to your house, or you come over to their house. Try different ways in which to reach this person and let them know that you're not adversarial, you're not trying to tear them down, you're not trying to take them out of their position, that you want to see them be successful, and that you want to help them. And in the process, you're helping yourself as well. If all else fails, and through meetings and such, you're not getting any success, at the very end, he said, how do we approach the mayor? I'd say you do not approach the mayor around the fire chief. I think that's over the line and inappropriate. If all else fails, you go to the fire chief and say, we've tried to accomplish these things in these different ways, and it isn't working. I'm requesting a meeting with you, the fire chief, the mayor, and me, or a group of us, that we all get together and we all talk these things through. But to go to the mayor around the fire chief without the fire chief knowing it, I think it is playing dirty. You try to work through the fire chief, and if you're not successful, then you tell the fire chief, can we schedule a meeting with the mayor and talk about this, because we're trying to accomplish some things that we're just not having any success with. That might be a wake-up call for the fire chief to say, geez, I better start paying attention to these guys. Or, they might go ahead and schedule the meeting. Realize the mayor favors the fire chief, so if you go into the meeting with the mayor, be courteous and professional, because the mayor already has, some sense of faith and confidence in the fire chief that he or she appointed.
Okay, Chief. Well, thank you very much. Great advice, as always. Again, if anybody listening does have a question for Chief Gassaway for the Leaders Toolbox show here, please do send us an email to podcast@firehouse.com. We'll be back in just a month with another edition of the Leaders Toolbox. Thank you for joining us.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening. And stay tuned to Firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.